Thank you. How many of you would admit that when you argue, you like to win? Okay, some of you don't have your hands up, which means you're either lying, in which case we need confession for you, or you're telling the truth, in which case we need counseling for you. I think we all like to win when we argue, and I want to take some time today to talk about arguing, because to be honest with you, arguing has been lost on our culture. People don't know how to argue anymore. In fact, Jonah Goldberg at National Review has written that we are now a culture of cliches, meaning we no longer present reasons for our view, which is what an argument really is. By the way, in case you're wondering, an argument is not saying to somebody, you're ugly and so is everybody else in your gene pool. That's an insult, and we're not talking about that. What we're talking about is making a persuasive case for what you believe. And Jonah Goldberg writes that that art of reasoning toward a conclusion has been lost. We're a cliched culture. In fact, we kind of know that here in California, don't we? We just recalled our governor. And by the way, I'm happy for that. But what was interesting is why the governor-elect was chosen in this state. I think there were good reasons to vote for who got elected, Arnold Schwarzenegger. However, what was interesting is the thing that got him elected was a television debate. I don't know how many of you saw this debate, but it was a case where Arnold Schwarzenegger was there, Tom McClintock, Arianna Huffington. Those were the three major players in this debate. And there was this incredible exchange that set the tone of the election. As far as I'm concerned, it decided it. What happened was Arianna Huffington turned to Arnold Schwarzenegger and said, "You know, Mr. Schwarzenegger, you just want to give big business loopholes so they don't have to pay taxes, and then they can exploit their poor workers. And you want to create these big, huge loopholes for rich businesses and corporations like Enron so they can exploit the little guy." I was listening to this going, wait a minute, Arianna, you haven't paid your taxes in 7 years. That just came out in the paper this last week. And of course, Arnold didn't miss a beat. He looked right at her and said, "Arianna, the biggest loophole is your own personal taxes. That loophole's so big I could drive Muhammad through it." And that was the election. It was over. You didn't know you were going to get Arnold thrown in, did you? Now, that line was carried throughout the world. I was in Canada last week and people were quoting that line. We live in a culture where substantive arguments are hard to find and they don't decide as much as they ought to, given the media culture we live in. But seriously, folks, we are engaged in a huge argument in our culture today. Greg and Chuck dealt with the first question we're arguing about as a culture. And that is truth true? Is truth real? Or is it just a preference like choosing chocolate ice cream over vanilla? And Greg has dealt with that adequately, in fact, more than adequately, and Chuck did as well last night. I will not spend a lot of time on that question. But there is a second matter we are arguing about. And this question, men and women, impacts your kids, your grandkids, the people you go to church with, and there is no way we will be able to escape this question if we as Christians want to have a voice on issues like abortion, embryonic stem cell research, and cloning. And that question is simply this: what makes human beings valuable? What makes human beings valuable? Are human beings valuable in virtue of the kind of thing they are, or are they only valuable for what they can do instrumentally? In fact, I'm holding a book right now called Practical Ethics by a gentleman by the name of Peter Singer, who Chuck referenced last night. Dr. Singer argues in this book that no newborn should be considered a person until 30 days after it's born, and that disabled infants can be ethically killed on the spot by the attending physician. And Dr. Singer argues that if you think human beings are intrinsically valuable in virtue of the kind of thing they are, which is the biblical worldview, humans have value simply because they're human. They're creatures made in the image of God. Singer says if you hold to the view that humans have intrinsic value, you're guilty of speciesism, which is a crime akin to racism. This is the battle that we are facing in our culture today, men and women, and it is driving the debate on embryonic stem cell research. It's driving the debate on cloning. It's certainly driving the debate on abortion. And Christians will have to decide, people like you and I, Will we engage this debate so that we can bring moral clarity to the issue? In fact, if I were to theme my remarks for today, it would be bringing moral clarity to a very unclear culture. Because what tends to happen is people think that because we disagree as a culture on issues like abortion, nobody's right. Or as Hadley Arkus puts it, people think that the absence of consensus means an absence of truth. Well, we know that can't possibly be true. People once disagreed on whether the earth was flat or round. Did it follow? Nobody was correct. People once disagreed on whether slavery ought to be permitted. Did that mean there were no right answers? But what you have is this sort of soft relativism that has creeped into the culture. Not everybody is as hardcore as Peter Singer. Not everybody is as hardcore on the truth question as that person Greg mentioned in the chiropractor's office this morning. The assistant who said, well, I don't know if it's wrong to murder people for fun. I don't know if I should ever impose that view. Now, we hear that and we think, boy, that sounds like some weird character in a novel somewhere. But you know, Greg's right on about that. According to George Barna, 9% of Christian high school students agree with the proposition that truth is real and knowable. 9%, men and women. Dare I say that we are not in good shape even in our own midst? I mentioned soft relativism. About 3 years ago, I was at the park. I went to the park with my youngest son, Michael. Michael is the interesting boy. He's the most affectionate of our three sons. And it was the case when he was three, if you took him to the park and put him on the swing and got that swing moving, you could read a novel as long as you kept that swing going. He's happy as can be, and so it was real easy to take him to the park. Well, one day I took him to the park, I put him in the swing, I got that swing going, wasn't there maybe 2 or 3 minutes, and a very well-dressed woman came. She was in like a lawyer's business pantsuit. She put her daughter on the swing next to Michael, began pushing the swing, and then she said to me, boy, you must have a great job where you can just come to the park in the middle of the day. I don't see many men around here usually. This is kind of odd. She said, well, what do you do? Now, normally I have to confess, if I'm on an airplane, I don't usually like to talk about what I do. I want to sleep. And so you get these questions like, well, what do you do for a living? And I'm not like some of my friends that think it's their duty to lead the entire 747 to Christ before we get to where we're going. I just become a staunch Calvinist. God's going to save whoever he wants, and I'm going to take a nap. Thank you very much. Theology can be very convenient, you know, especially when you switch hit. She said, well, what do you do for a living? And I said, I do lectures in bioethics. She said, well, I know what that is. And usually when I say I do lectures in bioethics, I'm off the hook. Nobody's going to ask me what that is. She says, oh, you talk about things like abortion. I said, yeah, that's right. She said, I think abortion's a really bad thing. I'm thinking, good. She said, but I'm glad it's legal. Now, we have a little tactic we use at Stand to Reason. In fact, Greg has done a very good job flushing this out for us. It goes like this. When someone says to you they personally oppose abortion, but they think it ought to be legal, we need to help take the spin off that for them. And so here's the question we ask. And this is exactly what I said to her. I said, tell me, why do you personally oppose abortion? She said, well, because it kills a baby. I said, do you mind if I repeat back what you just told me? You personally oppose abortion because it kills a baby, but you think it should be legal to kill babies? Men and women, for 30 seconds, stunned silence while she just pushed her daughter on the swing. And then she turned to me, to her credit, and said, you know what? That is what I'm saying. And it doesn't sound good when you take the spin off it. Men and women, that is exactly the kind of person we go to work with, we go to church with. Boy, if I could count the number of times I've had spiritual leaders say to me, I think abortion's wrong, but that's more of a personal decision, and I don't think we should legislate against it. Wow. We've got a problem on those two questions. What makes human beings valuable, and is truth true? And today I want to talk about three key questions you and I must ask as Christians if we're going to bring moral clarity to issues like abortion. Three key questions. And if you get a handle on these three questions, you will have the moral logic of the pro-life view put in place. On our resource table in the back there, we have a product we call Making Abortion Unthinkable, and I'll refer to this again toward the end of my talk. But this is a training tool to equip Christians to persuasively defend the moral logic of the pro-life view. And we did this product because we found that, largely speaking, people don't know the moral logic of the pro-life view. And it's hard for people to disagree with our view when they don't even know what it is we're arguing. And of course, it doesn't help when we don't do a good job arguing it. And as I think you can imagine, in a secular culture like ours today, simply saying the Bible says abortion's wrong, therefore you should think it's wrong, is not going to get the job done. Quoting Psalm 139 does not work with someone who rejects biblical authority. You've got to start with a place of reasoning with them where you can engage their intellect. This is not a non-biblical thing to do. Paul did it in his evangelistic tactics. We do it at Stand to Reason. We're not trying to say that Scripture is not authoritative. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm simply saying that if you don't have a way to argue for the pro-life view, advancing the moral logic of the pro-life view in terms that will work with secular people, we're in a heap of trouble. And today I want to give you the three questions that will enable you to discuss issues like abortion, embryonic stem cell research, and cloning with people who reject a biblical source of authority. And those three questions are simply this. Number one, what is the unborn? Now, you may think, boy, that's a basic no-brainer. Yeah, it is. You'd be surprised how often that question never enters the abortion debate. What is the unborn? Second question, which I have touched on but not expounded on already, is what makes human beings valuable? Are we valuable for what we are intrinsically, or only valuable for what we do instrumentally? In fact, if you look at the debate right now over embryonic stem cell research, that is precisely the question that's being debated. And thirdly, I'll close with this question: what is our duty? Given what we will know at the end of this session about what is the unborn and what makes human beings valuable, what should our duty be as Christians? And I will say a couple of things at the end of this talk that may seem a bit strong and surprising to you, but I'm prepared to argue for them. Because I am convinced that Christians, by and large, have not yet entered the fight on bioethical issues. Some have, but we have not done so collectively, largely because we've not been equipped. And I want to talk about how we equip ourselves, and we start with these three questions. Number one question, what is the unborn? It all begins there. It all begins there. In fact, the entire abortion debate, the debate over embryonic stem cell research, the debate over cloning, all come back to that one question, what is the unborn? In fact, let me borrow an example. I'll steal this one from Greg, too, since I'm borrowing a few other points of his. Greg came up with this great illustration one day, and I think I might have been with him when he did it. I think we were having lunch down near LAX, and he said, you know, he's scribbling this thing out on a napkin. He says, here's a way to think of abortion. Imagine your five-year-old comes into your kitchen while you're washing dishes, and he says to you with your back turned, Daddy, can I kill this? By the way, you don't think boys ask that question? I have three of them at home, and I hear it weekly, and usually he's got his brother by the neck when I hear the question. Daddy, can I kill this? What's the first question you're going to ask? What is it? You know, now, I do admit, dads are more liberal on that question than moms. Dads are like, sure, it's a snail, cockroach, have fun, don't show it to mom. You know, mom's horrified you're going to kill anything, even an ant. Well, you can't answer the question, can I kill this, till you answer the prior question, what is it? You simply can't. Now, how does this relate to an issue like abortion? I'll tell you how. Both sides of the abortion debate, those who favor it, those opposed to it, agree that abortion takes the life of something that's living. I mean, dead things don't grow, do they? I mean, something's alive in there. The debate is over what is that thing that's alive in the womb. It all comes down to that one question. In fact, we use a little tactic at Stand to Reason to illustrate that this is not a debate about choice, trusting women, privacy, or any of the other things that are thrown out as being the genuine issue. The real issue is one question, what is the unborn? And we use a tactic called trot out the toddler to show people that these other questions of privacy and choice are not relevant. For example, let's say someone says to you, we need abortion because too many unwanted children are going to grow up abused and abandoned, and we need to have a way to deal with that social problem. By the way, has it ever struck you as odd that abortion advocates are the only one with the gall to suggest that the way we end child abuse is to execute the victim? But anyway, some of you just got that lunch kicked in. I have a toddler in front of me. So someone says to me, look, we have got to have abortion to solve unwanted children. Trot out your toddler. Say to the person, I have a two-year-old in front of me. Notice the visual effect of putting the hand out there? I have a toddler here. He's unwanted. By the time he's five, he's going to be abused, abandoned, and roughed up pretty good. Would it be okay to kill him now so that he is not abused later? What will be their answer immediately? No, you can't do that because he is a human being. At that point, one word reply, ah. In fact, you should get that ah down. It's very useful. Ah. Then if the unborn are human, like that toddler, should we kill the unborn because he's unwanted any more than we'd kill the toddler? Oh, but that's not the same thing. The unborn aren't human. The toddler is. Your reply, one word? Ah, that's the issue. Are they the same? Now, just a little time out here. Have I yet argued my position at all? No. What have I done? I framed the issue. Fact number one rule when you do debates, frame the issue or be framed yourself. It's either your opponent or you who's going to frame the issue. When we don't frame the issue around the question, what is the unborn? Very simply, we lose because it's too easy for people to distract the audience from the real issue. Real issue is simply, what is it? This is not a debate about privacy. Does anybody we know argue that Andrea Yates, the mother who drowned her five toddlers in a bathtub in Texas, that we ought to let her out of jail because that's a private decision we ought not interfere in? No, we prosecuted her. Why? Because her children were what? Human beings. Ah, if the unborn are human like those other children in that bathtub, should we kill the unborn in the name of privacy any more than we would those other children? You see, men and women, it all comes down to the one question. What is the unborn? In fact, I began a debate at USC 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago to the date, with a colleague of mine that I debate regularly. He's an ACLU attorney, Planned Parenthood board member, and this was at USC, University of Southern California, and I spoke first in front of the student audience, and I began the debate this way. I said, men and women, I'm here to concede that my friend and colleague Ed has won this debate and I've lost. In other words, I'm here to concede that we should not under any circumstances pass laws restricting abortion. Not even partial birth abortion should be outlawed. Furthermore, I think our tax dollars ought to pay for abortion for any reason a woman wants one. And beyond that, I think pro-lifers ought to keep to themselves and quit telling women what to do. If a woman wants an abortion, that's her business. Let's butt out. That's right, men and women, I said to the audience. I am here to concede that my friend has won. I've reevaluated my position, and here I am 12 years later coming to his conclusion. He's won this debate. I've lost. If all the pro-lifers in the audience had passed out by that point. If. If what? If the unborn are not human. And all he has to do is scientifically and philosophically present evidence to show they're not human, and we should all concede the debate to his position. But you see, men and women, I said to the audience, make no mistake. He must present evidence. Choice will not do the work. In fact, I said, I am vigorously pro-choice on women choosing their own husbands, boyfriends, healthcare providers, careers, educational goals, where they want to live. But some choices are wrong, like taking the lives of defenseless human beings simply because they're in the way and can't defend themselves. No, that's not a choice we should allow. We should not allow a choice that allows us to take the lives of defenseless human beings. My opponent, Ed, thinks that's okay, and I think he's right if the unborn aren't human. Let's see what he has to say. Now, what was our debate going to be about that evening? One question. What is the unborn? It wasn't going to do him any good to talk about privacy. I had taken that issue away from him. Wasn't going to do him any good to talk about choice. I had taken that issue away. Wasn't going to do any good to talk about forcing morality. That issue was off the table. There was one question he had to argue. What is the unborn? And it took him about 15 minutes of his opening monologue at USC to reorganize his notes and come up with something to say. He was shocked when I said I conceded the debate. As were the people on my side of the issue. Now, the truth is, factually, you need to know that the pro-life position is extremely easy to defend from a scientific viewpoint. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to do this. Let me just give you one sentence that sums up the scientific evidence. I challenge anybody to find an embryology textbook that will say different than what I'm about to tell you. Here it is. From the earliest stages of development, in other words, from conception, the unborn are distinct, living, whole human beings. I'll say that again. From the earliest stages of development, the unborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. Now, watch this. Right now, I am plucking cells off my hand. These cells contain my genetic material, my DNA code. Have I just committed mass murder? Well, the answer is no, because these cells are merely part of a larger human being, me. They are not whole living human beings the way the embryo is. In other words, there's a difference in kind between each of our cells and the genetically distinct living whole human being that is the human embryo. There is a difference in kind. Abortion advocates would have us believe there is no difference in kind, but that's simply bad science that cannot be sustained by any embryology textbook I have seen anywhere. So when we ask the question, what is the unborn, it's really simple. The unborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. Yes, they have yet to grow and mature. Yes, they are dependent. Yes, they are small. But those things are irrelevant differences, as I'll show you in just a few moments. What's interesting is, once we lay out our scientific case, people tend to ignore the evidence and go instead for a distraction. I don't know how many of you ever saw the show Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher. Did any of you ever watch that show when it was on? We're going to have a healing service for you at the end of the session. Bill Maher was no friend of conservatives. He would usually stack the deck by having four liberals ganging up on one conservative, which made it about even. And one night his guest was Kathy Ireland, the former supermodel who is now a lifestyle consultant. And Kathy was on the show, and Bill Maher turned to her and said, "Kathy, why do you oppose a woman's right to choose abortion?" Kathy said, "I'll tell you why. I used to be pro-choice, Bill, but then my husband went to medical school. And I began to read there that there's this law we talk about called biogenesis, which has to do with the fact that living things reproduce after their own kind. That means, for example, that dogs produce dogs, and cats produce cats, and humans produce humans. And I reasoned that because the unborn come from human parents, they too are members of the human family, and we ought not harm them without justification. And I think elective abortion harms a member of the human family without justification. That's why I oppose it." Now, was that a good answer? Great answer. Factual. She gave evidence for her claim. She didn't invent a response willy-nilly. She gave evidence for her claim. In other words, she argued. Listen to Bill Maher's response and think back to what I said a moment ago about how we've become a culture of cliches. Here was his reply. "Well, gee, Kathy, that's just your view." Now, this fits classic definition of what Chuck talked about last night, postmodernism. The belief, in essence, that there is no truth. There's no truth between what we say is real and what actually is real. All we have are personal opinions, cliches, or stories, but nothing that is substantially true. I get this in debates all the time. Wherever I go and I do debates on abortion, on the radio, in public appearances, and I do quite a few of them on college campuses, somewhere in the debate it will come up, "Well, gee, Scott, you just think there's such a thing as truth, and there really is no truth." And as Chuck said last night, the question to ask is that a true statement? Greg has a nice way of putting it. He says, "Look, that's an argument that commits suicide. It would be like me saying my brother is an only child, or I can't speak a word in English, or the Raiders are the best team in football, or something that can't possibly be true." That was an attempt to bond with my audience, and it may have just gone down in flames. But Something that can't possibly be true, but we work with people who think like that, and especially on issues like abortion. Oh, there's other ways people change the topic as well. I remember at the University of Calgary, this was in 1999, I went up there to do a debate against the chair of the philosophy department at the University of Calgary. And I was loaded for grizzly, thinking, oh man, am I going to encounter a real tough guy here? And it was interesting because it wasn't really that, I'm just trying to be kind here, it just wasn't that tough of a debate, to be honest with you. There weren't any real substantial arguments put forward for the other side. And as a result, at the end of the debate, some students who weren't very happy with how their spokesperson had performed surrounded me and made it very clear that they wanted me to explain some things. So these 30 students come up to me and surround me after the debate, and their leader is a woman from Calgary. She's a middle-aged woman. She's the pro-abortion activist leader for that community, I guess. And she looked at me and said, "How dare you come here and talk about abortion?" I said, "Well, why am I not entitled to express my view?" She says, "Not when you're a man, you aren't. You're a man. You can't get pregnant. What right do you have to come and talk on abortion when you're a man and you can't get pregnant?" And borrowing a line from my friend Frank Beckwith, I said, "How do you know that I'm a man?" She said, "What?" And inside I'm going, "I can't believe I just said that. I am going to die." I said, "How do you know that I'm a man?" She said, "Well, that's silly. You look like one." You know, at that point, I thought, I am so far out on this limb, I'm just going to saw it off behind me. I said, "Well, maybe I'm a pro-life cross-dresser." She said, "But you sound like a man." And before I could even think about it, I said, "But so does Joan Rivers." Now, I don't advise this as a tactic. I did it once, and I'll never do it again. Help me, Jesus. But my point was a serious one. Arguments don't have gender. People do. And by the way, don't women who are pro-life use the same exact arguments I do? Identical. So you can't refute my case by attacking me personally. You have to deal with my case. You can't just dismiss it because you don't like my gender. Now, that's a rather humorous example, but I've got something serious to ask you. How do you and I reach a culture that has forgotten how to argue, who substitutes cliches for evidence, who thinks there's no truth? How do we reawaken that culture's moral sensibilities? And I want to suggest to you that words alone may not be enough. Words alone may not be enough. Dr. Neil Postman, in a very insightful book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, has argued that with the advent of television 50 or 55 years ago, that America shifted from being a word-based culture where we made careful linear arguments to becoming an image-based culture where we make decisions based on what we feel, what we see, and our rather naive intuitions. And Postman says that in the advent of a television age, the ability to think and learn critically is greatly diminished. And in that kind of environment, reaching people at the eye level, not as a substitute for a good argument, but as a way to begin the discussion, is profoundly important. And with that in mind, we're going to show you in just a few moments here a video clip that I have used in every debate I've done on abortion. We use it on college campuses. We show it in churches. We show it places where people have lost a sense of what the word abortion means. And this video clip I'm about to show you, which is approximately 2 minutes in length, it's very short. This two-minute video contains pictures of aborted fetuses. And some might say, well, why do we need to show that kind of thing? Well, for the same reason that teachers show horrific pictures of bodies stacked like cordwood in the Nazi death camps. For the same reasons that when professors at San Francisco State University, not far from here, lecture on the Vietnam War, they show pictures of children running from a napalm village, naked children who have been burned by the bombs, and we think that's entirely appropriate. Why? because those pictures convey the truth in a way words don't. And when we let people see what abortion is, it reawakens their moral sensibilities in a way that words alone cannot do. Now, it's important that we are careful how we use these clips. For example, whenever I'm speaking to an audience like I am today, or at a debate at a college, I always make the point to tell people what they're going to see. I don't surprise them. I tell them exactly what they're going to see. Then I tell them to please feel free not to watch. In fact, I tell them, you may not want to watch. This is really disturbing stuff. Of course, what happens when I say, it's really disturbing and you don't want to watch? Everybody's looking and nobody's complaining. Then, of course, I want to say one other thing, and this is especially true in a Christian setting. It's easy to think that in our churches and in Christian settings, there aren't people who've been wounded by abortion, and I want you to know, as I'm sure you do, that that is simply not the case. 87 million Americans have been involved in a decision to end a baby's life. That's not just the women who had abortions, but the boyfriends who encouraged them, the parents who coerced their daughter to have an abortion, other relatives who weighed in on this subject. And it's very tough for those people to hear a topic like what we're addressing today without feeling a profound sense of psychic pain. And we want to make it clear that we're not here just to inflict pain for pain's sake. Quite to the contrary. We believe that godly sorrow leads to repentance, which leads to what? Paul says, life. How do people get healed from the sin of abortion? Not by the church ignoring it, men and women, but by us talking about it in a very compelling way, with compassion, but nonetheless compelling way that reawakens people's moral sense of right and wrong. That is key. This video clip does just that. And when you tell people what they're about to watch, you give them the option of looking away, and you tell them that Christ is willing to forgive the sin of abortion, provided there is repentance, then there can be an opportunity for healing there that doesn't come when we just slap people over the head with a picture. With stand to reason, we believe in being gracious ambassadors for Christ, and we use this film graciously. We don't use it in a heavy-handed way. I want you to see it so you can be aware of it. This clip we're showing you is part of the video curriculum I mentioned just a moment ago, Making Abortion Unthinkable, which is available on the back table. And this clip is a way to restore meaning to the word abortion in a way words can't. So without further delay, we'll go ahead and roll this clip, and then I'll finish. Seeing a clip like that some would still wonder, is it really necessary to show something that provocative to restore meaning to the word abortion, even in a postmodern culture? And I'm reminded of an event that took place in this nation's history that was shameful, one of the darkest blotches on our otherwise positive national history. In 1955, an African-American boy who was 14 by the name of Emmett Till took a journey from Chicago, where he lived, to visit his cousins in the town of Money, Mississippi. And of course, as you can imagine, Mississippi today is very different than Mississippi of 1955. In 1955, if you were black, you didn't even make eye contact with white people because it was a sign of disrespect if you did. Well, Emmett Till got off the train from Chicago and met his cousins at the station and said, "Hey, it's good to be here, but you know what? You guys got to come up to Chicago next time because Chicago's a great town." His cousins are like, "Oh yeah, why? What's so good about Chicago? We like it here." Emmett said, "Oh, no, you got to understand. Back in Chicago, I have two girlfriends, and they're both white girls." His cousin said, "Uh-uh, we're not buying this. No way. Here, we don't even talk to white women." "What do you mean you've got two white girlfriends back in Chicago?" He says, "No, I do." And then they said, without realizing what they were saying, they said to him, "We dare you to talk to a white woman here." Emmett said, "Sure." Later that afternoon, they went to a convenience store. Emmett purchased a piece of gum. As he turned to leave, he flashed a grin at the white clerk behind the counter, waved at her and said, "Thanks, baby," and turned to walk out the door. There were two black gentlemen playing chess on the front porch of that store. And they heard what Emmett said. And as he left, they said, "Boy, you better get out of here. They're going to kill you." And it wasn't long after that, but at 2 o'clock in the morning, Emmett Till was extracted at gunpoint from his uncle's home where he was staying. And the next time anybody saw Emmett Till, he didn't look anything like he did before. His body, his face was so disfigured, so badly beaten in and crushed, that the coroner at first was not sure it was actually a human body. He placed Emmett's body in a coffin, sealed it, and shipped it back to his mother in Chicago and said, "Don't open this." When Emmett Till's mother got the body, she called a press conference and she said, "I want you to know we're going to have a funeral for my boy Emmett, and it's going to be an open casket funeral." And people were horrified. "You can't do that. You're going to offend people. This funeral is taking place in a church. You can't do this. It's irreverent. You will offend and upset people." She said, "I know. But I want the whole world to see what they did to my boy." And that picture of Emmett Till's body in that coffin, which you can view on the internet, it's a black and white photo, but it's still powerful, was shipped across the United States, published widely in places like Jet Magazine, and it is one of the primary triggers for the civil rights movement that ensued a few short years later. In fact, sociologist after sociologist, even Rosa Parks, credited the picture of Emmett Till as giving her the courage not to leave or to move from the back of the bus, to not leave the front of the bus. Rosa Parks cites that photo. And men and women, I believe that we as Christians will not escape this culture's tendency to trivialize injustice unless we are willing to open the casket on abortion. It needs to be opened in our churches. It needs to be opened on our school campuses, in our Christian schools, high schools especially, in our church youth groups. We need to do it lovingly. But if we don't open that casket, men and women, our culture will not be forced to deal with the question, what is the unborn? The culture will continue to trivialize injustice, just like it did prior to 1955. Leads me to my second question, what makes human beings valuable? 10 days ago in Canada, I tried something interesting. I held up a $20 Canadian bill. Some of you are thinking, that's a lot of money, not in Canada. It's worth about $12 here. I held up a $20 Canadian bill and I said, you know, get the scene. High school auditorium, 600 high school students and bleachers up in the gymnasium, right? I said, how many of you would want this? Every hand went up. Then I took the $20 bill and I wrinkled it up into the smallest little ball I could and said, now how many of you want it? Every hand went up. Then I stuck it, rolled it up, stuck it on the ground, squashed it some more with my feet, made it even smaller and said, now how many of you want it? We all want it. Every hand went up. And I threw it into the crowd and became an instant legend. I said, how come you wanted the bill? And I mean, all across those bleachers in unison, here was the reply. Because it's valuable for what it is. In other words, they got it. It didn't matter that its size had changed, its shape had changed, its appearance had changed. That bill was valuable for what it is intrinsically. And I said, you know, of course we can't compare humans to money in terms of their ultimate value, but the principle holds. Human beings, like that $20 bill, are valuable for what they are intrinsically. In fact, I said to these students, I said, you know, there's only four differences between the embryo you once were and the students you are today. Only four. And none of these four differences are relevant such that we can say you had no value when you were smaller, and now today you have value. Only four differences. And I gave them this little acronym we use called SLED to help them see and remember the four differences and to show that those differences are irrelevant. I said, look, when you were an embryo, you were smaller, there's your S. You were less developed, there's your L. You were in a different environment, there's your E. And you were more dependent. Your degree of dependency was greater. I said, let's look at those four things. Size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency. Think a sled, I told them. And let's see if we can see if any of those are morally relevant. Okay. Size, I said. Were you smaller as an embryo? Yeah. I said, but since when does how tall you are or how big you are determine the rights you ought to have? Men are generally larger than women. Does it follow men deserve more rights than women do? Or, as we might say to ourselves here today, is Shaquille O'Neal more human than someone like Senator Hillary Clinton simply because he's larger? Okay, a few of you are smirking. He may be more human, but size is not the issue. Size does not matter. It's not less a crime to beat a small child than it is a large one. What about level of development? Yeah, it's true. You were less developed as an embryo, as a fetus. But a 4-year-old girl is less developed than a 14-year-old girl. A 4-year-old girl does not even have a functioning reproductive system yet, none of us here, I said to the audience, would consider her less valuable because of it. In fact, I said to the kids, you are less developed than your parents. You're less developed than your parents physically, and you're less developed than your parents intellectually, which I know comes as a shock to many of you, I said to the students. But the fact is, you won't reach your intellectual peak until your mid-40s. Does it follow you're less valuable than your parents simply because they're more developed? Size, level of development. What about environment? I said, where you are has no bearing on who you are. Does it follow that because you rolled over in bed last night that you changed location when you did, that you somehow became a new person? What about when you walked from the hallway into this gymnasium? Did you stop being you? If not, how does a journey of 8 inches down the birth canal transform a tissue blob into something we ought to protect legally and hold as valuable? How does a change of location accomplish that? And finally, degree of dependency. I said, if we're going to say that only those who can live independent of anyone or anything count as valuable human beings, then some of us have relatives that are not valuable, and we may kill them. Because some of us have relatives who depend on insulin, heart pacemakers, and other things without which they can't survive. Does it follow they have less value than us? Only four differences: size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. And none of those are good reasons for saying we had no value as embryos and fetuses, but now today we do. And you know what? They got it. That little simple acronym gave them a way to visualize the fact there's no relevant difference between what they were as embryos and what they are today. We've just done something today. We've laid out a case for the pro-life view. We've argued scientifically that the unborn are living, distinct, whole human beings. We've argued philosophically that there's no relevant difference between the embryos we once were and the adults we are today. And that leads me to my final question. What is our duty? Given those facts, what is our duty? And I think I should preface what I'm about to say by pointing out that one of my biggest fears is that our culture today has lost its sense of outrage. And I'll give you a couple of examples. In January of 2000, I was scheduled to debate at the University of Illinois a woman by the name of Eileen McDonough. Eileen McDonough argues as follows. Pro-lifers are correct, she grants for the sake of argument. Pro-lifers are correct that the fetus is human. She'll even call it a person. She thinks there's somehow a difference between a human who isn't a person and a human who is. I think she needs to argue for that. But that aside, she'll even say it's a human person. But just as a woman has a right to use deadly force against a rapist who invades her body without consent, so she may use deadly force against a fetus who invades her body without consent. And you and I have a moral obligation, she calls it that, a moral obligation to fund that act of self-defense on her behalf. That's right, pregnancy equals rape. A year earlier, a couple on the East Coast, Brian Peterson and Amy Grossberg, gave birth to their infant son in a hotel room. And when he was born, they killed him. They were high school sweethearts. They killed their infant son and placed his lifeless body in a dumpster. And they got 2 years jail time for doing that. And they got out early for good behavior. And earlier that same year, as Mona Sharon points out in syndicated column, a man in Wisconsin killed a dozen cats and got 12 years. But as she points out, they were wanted cats. And men and women, as we're here today at our worldview conference, there's an abortionist in Wichita, Kansas, who kills human fetuses in the third trimester of pregnancy. That's right, the 7th, 8th, and 9th months of pregnancy, for only mildly disabling defects. And he raises the issue with impunity on the internet. And do you know why the good people of Wichita tolerate Dr. Tiller? It's because he's not killing kitties. And today I wonder how bad we want to win this fight. How bad do we want to win it? Jesus said that we're to love our neighbor. Is the unborn our neighbor? Yes, he is, if he's a human being. What does it mean to love our neighbor? It's not just a feeling. Jesus taught that love, biblically understood, is a behavior. It's something we do. In fact, he told the parable of the Good Samaritan to illustrate dramatically that we have a duty to go beyond mere feeling. Remember the story? The priest and the Levite passed by on the other side of the road. And Jesus said, that's not good enough. He castigated them, not because they didn't feel pity. They would have. But because they didn't act like they felt pity. What does it mean to act that we feel pity for the unborn? I want to say a statement that I said at the beginning of this talk is potentially controversial, but I'll say it anyway. The pro-life movement today, by and large, there are notable exceptions, but by and large is a movement of amateurs. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. Let me explain what I mean. Our leadership is primarily hardworking moms ages 25 to 45 who are trying to do pro-life work while they're busy doing what? Raising their kids. Let's look at the other side of this debate, the pro-abortion side. It's led by full-time professionals from academia, journalism, law, medicine, who do nothing but work full time to kill human fetuses. And as Greg Cunningham points out, there's a reason for that. That's because killing babies is very profitable, while saving them is very costly. So costly, says Greg, that vast numbers of people who say they oppose abortion hardly lift a finger to stop it. Let me propose something radical to think about. We have college students here from Berkeley, and I want to speak to you a moment. Pardon me for being so bold. I wonder how many of you would be willing to consider pro-life advocacy as a career choice. What would happen to the pro-life movement if we got full-time workers who were paid, meaning they're not going to burn out because they can't pay the bills and because their family's tired of eating peanut butter and celery? What if we could get vast numbers of people working full-time to end abortion? And listen to my thought here. Not by just going in front of clinics, but by arguing the moral logic of the pro-life view in the public square. In other words, if Campus Crusade and the Navigators and InterVarsity can put thousands of self-supporting staff in the field who raise their own support, who learn to raise their own support, why can't the pro-life movement do it? And what would that do to this debate at the cultural level? Now, I realize that I'm proposing something here that seems radical. Just so you know that I practice what I preach, I raise my salary. Just so you know. And we have another guy on our staff, Steve Wagner, who raises his salary. And we have Brett Kunkel in the back who's raising his salary. Why? Because we want full-time people arguing Christian apologetics in the public square. And it's not going to be done as long as pro-life advocacy is a part-time amateur enterprise. We have a girl in Canada, Stephanie Gray. When she was 18, she did something on her campus at the University of British Columbia. She brought up to Canada what's called the GAP display, the Genocide Awareness Project. Imagine going onto the campus at UC Berkeley and seeing panels that are two stories high, like this side of a panel right here, and what have you, with about 30 of those set up in a gigantic triangle in the middle of the campus at UC Berkeley, with warning signs on all the walkways saying, if you don't want to see graphic abortion photos, walk this way, which means everybody does what? Walks and looks at them. The word abortion suddenly has meaning on campus. Well, Stephanie brought this display in a smaller format to University of British Columbia, and the pro-abortion students, exercising their tolerant views, tore down her display and beat up some of her volunteers. What did 18-year-old Stephanie Gray do? Turned around and sued the attackers in court in Canada, and then raised the money to replace the signs, and then went out and hired Canada's premier free speech attorney, Craig Jones, who's not even pro-life, and he went to bat arguing for the pro-life students. And they won the right to display that display regularly at the University of British Columbia. She was 18. She's now 22, has raised her own salary, goes all over Canada lecturing, teaching the pro-life apologetics that we advocate here. 22. I'd love to see thousands of Stephanie Grays working in the United States to end abortion. Is it too much to ask? Oh, it's a challenge. But is it really too much? I think of Oscar Schindler. You've seen the movie, Schindler's List. At the end of that movie, there's a powerful scene where Oscar Schindler leaves the factory where he's saying goodbye to all the people he's ransomed with his money. As you know, he bought people off the death list who were scheduled to be executed. And as he's leaving the factory, the war has ended, he's saying goodbye to the hundreds of people he's ransomed. He walks out of the factory, which should have been a happy moment. He looks and he sees his car. And he stops and he says, "My car. I kept my car." His associate said, "What are you talking about, Oscar? That's your car." He says, "No, you don't understand. I kept the car. I could have sold it and bought another 10 people. I didn't do enough." He then looks at his jacket. He's got this decorative pin on his lapel. He rips it off, holds it out, says, "This pin, I kept this pin. I could have sold it and bought another 2. I didn't do enough." And the movie ends with Oscar Schindler weeping, repeating that phrase, "I didn't do enough." Men and women, do we take our Holocaust as seriously as Oscar Schindler took his? If we do, we need to be equipped. I hope every one of you here, and I don't say this merely as a sales pitch, I say it because I want you to be equipped. I hope every one of you in this room will do one of two things. I hope, first of all, you'll go back to the resource table and get a copy of Making Abortion Unthinkable. Do you realize you could train a group of adults at your church to use this and impart to them the moral logic of the pro-life view? It's turnkey, folks. Put the video in and push play if that's all you want to do. If you want to be more creative, there's a CD with workbooks on it. Secondly, if you don't want to use Making Abortion Unthinkable, that's fine. We have a book back there called A Woman's Right to Know. I hope you'll pick that book up. It's $2. And it's something that will outline for you the moral logic of the pro-life view. If we'll equip ourselves, I'm convinced God will use us. And one day abortion will end in this country. and we won't have to say we didn't do enough. God bless you as you equip yourself for action.
Thank you, Scott. Would you take a moment and lead us in a prayer? I don't think we can just walk into our small groups here when something of this consequence and this magnitude is on our hearts and on our minds.
Father in heaven, we thank you for two eternal truths. Number one, you are the God of life. Life is precious because it bears your image. And Lord, as your image bearers, we ask that you would make us agents of change in this culture. And Father, I pray you would help us to do two things very well. Three things, really. Number one, you would help us to teach with conviction the moral logic of the pro-life view. Secondly, I pray you would equip us and give us hearts of compassion to reach out to the millions of men and women who've been touched by abortion and who need healing. And Lord, I pray you would teach us to be salt and light in this culture so that working through our institutions, working through law, working through elected officials, one day abortion will end in this country. I pray, Lord, for any here today who this topic has touched them at a very personal level because of past experience, I pray your hand would be on them, that they would not despair, but they would recognize that godly sorrow has value. We don't sorrow as the world. We sorrow that leads to repentance, that can lead to life, as Paul said in Corinthians. We ask these things for Jesus' sake. Amen.
So young and only playing around, and I was ready for adventure, not for settling down. So when Janie told me she was pregnant and that she wanted to be my wife, I said, wait a minute, Janie, we're only 17, we're just starting out our young lives. Let's keep our heads together, girl. Let's look at all of our options. But we both knew what the choices were. There was abortion or adoption. And the doctor we saw, he said it wasn't really life. It's just a formless mass of cells. And so Janie and I, we made our choice. And we promised we never tell. But leaving the clinic, we heard some talk, and it shattered our little world. The doctor was telling the nurses that the baby was a girl. Would she have brown hair? Did she have blue eyes? I've tried to imagine what she would look like so many times. Would she be a tall girl? Oh, the question's on my mind. Did she have blue eyes like Janie's and brown hair like mine? I saw Janie just the other day in a pro-life movement line. We were in front of the courthouse steps, praying and carrying signs. And Janie came up to talk to me, and there were tears in her blue eyes. She said, there's been millions of innocent babies like ours have already died. And I can't stand on the sidelines anymore and watch that number grow. Not after what you and I've been through, not knowing what we know. I still wake up late some nights and think I heard her call my name. And I still have her photograph in an empty picture frame. Would she have brown hair? Did she have blue eyes? I've tried to imagine what she would look like so many times. Would she be a tall girl? Oh, the question's on my mind. Did she have blue eyes like Jane's and brown hair like mine? Did she have blue eyes like Jane's and brown hair like mine?
As with any new teaching, a one-time review of this message is not enough. We encourage you to listen to this recording again and again to get everything out of it that God wants you to receive. We pray that if you think of others who would benefit from this message, that you would make copies of it and share it with them. Take the time to make a difference in someone's life today.
For training materials and messages like the one you've just heard, contact ProLifeTraining.com. Or for more information about scheduling Scott Klusendorf, call 719-264-7861. Once again, for scheduling Scott Klusendorf, call 719-264-7861. For a wide variety of resources and recorded messages, please contact Stand to Reason at str.org or call 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON.